Hello and welcome to the latest edition of the Mimiverse Monthly Audiocast. I am your host, writer-director Christopher R. Mim. Thank you so much for being here. Are you there? Are you listening? I sure as heck hope so, because it is an exciting time to be a Mimivite, which is the name that Mike Cook, you all know Mike Cook, he's played several characters, Dr. Edwards, Gustav the Canoe Cop. He came up with that term to describe fans of the Mimiverse. So, Demo with the Atomic Brain came out just barely over a month ago, like a month and a day by the time this is released. What'd you think? I'm guessing you've seen it, right? And if you haven't, that surprises me a little bit. You should see it, of which you can order it right now at SaintEuphoria.com or at Amazon. Check it out. Now, we have a lot of stuff to cover this month before we do other fun stuff, like hear from Rich Chamberlain at the Kansas City Crypt, Chapter 8 of For Your Eyes Only, and Dr. Bob's got a joke to tell. So we're going to jump right into it. Lots of news. First and foremost, Demo with the Atomic Brain has been released. And the premiere was a fantastic time. The crowd was amazing. And I think it went smashingly. The response to the film has been overwhelmingly positive. This movie is definitely being considered by a lot of people one of the better movies that I've made. I still genuinely maintain it's probably my best, but that's just my opinion. I know other folks have talked to me, and a couple people said, oh, I really like that one. I thought Demon was great, but I still like this one better. I still like The Giant Spider or Where Skeeter or whatever. That's cool. You can like whatever one you want. I'm not going to stop you. But I personally, I'm just very proud of it. And I think we pulled off a lot in a very short time with a very limited budget. One of the stars, Brian Gibson, who plays Dr. Denning, made a comment on the Films of Christopher R. Mim page on Facebook that he was shocked when he saw it, that it turned out, as he said, quote unquote, more professional than he thought it would. And he made it clear that he didn't mean that in like a negative way. I actually understand what he's saying. At least my interpretation of it was, and he kind of clarified this, is that when you're working on one of my films, compared to working on a big budget or even just a modestly budgeted film. See, my films aren't even modestly budgeted. They're micro-budgeted. So when you're working on one of those, you have all these people who are doing behind-the-scenes roles. You have a lot of people. Everyone, you kind of follow a script, which sounds stupid because we're making a movie. Of course you follow a script. But no, everyone has their roles and everyone does their thing. On my movies, we have no money. So everyone does multiple jobs. And so there's a certain level of chaos that comes with working on my films that permeates everything. We move very quickly. Our crews are really small, sometimes as small as like one or two people. I do the cinematography as well as directing, as well as the sound. I mean, it's like everyone's doing so much stuff that it almost feels like, oh yeah, we're just making some dumb movie with this guy in his basement. He even made a point. He said, for as much as we sort of screwed around, it was amazing that it turned out to be as high quality as it was. I think that's a testament to the process that over 12 films we've built. It's not the same process that probably anyone else uses, but it's my process that works for me. And I know that Brian hadn't seen maybe even any of my films up to this point, so I don't know exactly what his perceptions were going in, but I'm glad to have surprised him coming out. And I've heard that before, and I was sort of expecting that to come out of working with new people who weren't necessarily familiar with my previous work. On its face, when you're in it, and you're making this cheesy, goofy movie, and you're working with people who are just having a really good time, and you got these tiny little crews, and, you know, in these rinky little sets in my basement. I mean, it feels like a micro-budget film when you're making it. I do think, and I'm kind of proud of this, that my movies do not feel like micro-budget films once they're released. I think we pull it off in spades with Demon with the Atomic Brain. So if you haven't seen it, order a copy and check it out. I think you're going to like it. I really do like it. I'm very proud of it. I'm proud of all the work everybody did. It's some of the best I think the Mimiverse has ever produced. And I'm really happy with it. I really, really am. And it's been selling well. I mean, sometimes, you know, you release a movie and it's just crickets. This one has not been crickets, and that's good. So, yeah. For the last month, I have been traveling and doing events pretty much nonstop. Tonight, when I'm recording this, which is actually November 1st, and I'm going to be releasing this tonight. I mean, that's how far behind I am. Tonight was really the first night I had to relax after the release of the movie. And even that week leading up to the release of the new film, it was just busy, busy, busy every night. Literally traveled thousands of miles just to promote the new film and do screenings and really push the Mimiverse. But that's October. We call it the screening season for a reason. We stay busy, and I stay especially busy. It's been good. I have no complaints, honestly. We still have some cool events coming up, too. The day this is released, November 2nd, Demon with the Atomic Brain will be playing at the Lake 5 Theater in Forest Lake. And then this weekend, I'll be at Crypticon Minneapolis, selling DVDs and showing Demon with the Atomic Brain. After that, I'll be down in Texas again at Waxicon and Waxahachie. Then on December 3rd, we're in Eau Claire showing Demon with the Atomic Brain for the Chippewa Valley folks. And then on December 9th, we're doing the first ever Mimiverse Christmas show. We'll be in St. Michael, Minnesota, which is just a little bit north of the Twin Cities, at this really great theater where we're going to be showing Danny Johnson Saves the World. All the kids who show up are getting a cool little holiday gift bag. And then the robot from the film's going to show up, as will Santa and Mrs. Claus. And here's the cool thing. It's actually a benefit for the American Cancer Society because it's the holiday season. You know, it's a time for giving. It'll be a free show with, you know, a suggested donation. We'll be asking for donations at this event. A portion of all my sales at this event will go to the American Cancer Society. Wait, there's some other really cool news, and I'm really excited to talk about this. On Halloween, just a couple days ago from the release of this, I revealed what I'm doing next. And that is, I'm going to hashtag do the Western. Sort of. My next film has been announced. It is called Guns of the Apocalypse. It is, as I describe it, a post-apocalyptic spaghetti Midwestern. There has been this discussion for many, many years about the idea of doing a Mimiverse Western. And I'm going to be honest with you, I was never that interested in that idea. Going backwards and doing a traditional Western, it just didn't necessarily fit with what I was interested in doing. I felt it would be an interesting challenge, but there are so many other challenges that come with making a full-blown Western that would be very, very difficult for me to pull off on the kinds of budgets I'm used to. And honestly, I don't know. I'm not a huge Western guy, right? I always say it. I'm more of a sci-fi guy than anything else. The idea of doing a Western was never really my cup of tea until I was inspired by the angle of making it post-apocalyptic, because I am very much interested in post-apocalyptic stories. And with everything going on in the news these days, the chance of nuclear holocaust seems strangely closer than it should be. And let's just say, I saw this wide open space in Stillwater, Minnesota, and I was just inspired by it, because near this wide open space was this giant electric transmission tower. And from the juxtaposition of this wild, wide-open, beautiful Midwestern space and this electricity transmission tower, for some reason, the two things together became post-apocalyptic. And I imagined building a house there and trying to rebuild your life after something as horrible as the apocalypse. It came together in a very beautiful way. And it was one of those ideas that once it started germinating, took off. And just being there in that beautiful country, you know, the gorgeousness of all that, everything around me, engulfing me, which this sounds really weird now, but it clicked at that moment, the idea of doing something post-apocalyptic. And then I realized, after seeing the movie Wind River, which, if you get a chance to see it, I highly recommend it. In essence, it's a Western, but it's not a Western. It takes place in modern times. And the basis of the story is very classic Western, just the style of story. But there are no horses. They're on snowmobiles instead. But the big vistas, the big shots of nature and man's role in it and all these things. And there's something beautiful about that movie. And it's quiet and introspective and kind of dark. And then you have these moments of extreme violence that made me sort of step outside of my preconceived notions of what Westerns could be and realize that a Western doesn't have to be the old West. A Western is It's just a style. It's a very specific thing. This may sound weird, but often when I'm coming up with ideas for what I want to do next, for several years now, I have always sort of waited until the last minute, partially because I'm working up to the last minute possible to get whatever I'm working on out. Like Demon with the Atomic Brain, it's like I finished the movie and then within a month or so it was released to the public. So, I mean, there's a lot of work into the last possible moment. I try to avoid thinking about whatever's next until I finished what I'm working on, because I feel like I can easily get ahead of myself and lose focus and lose sight of what I'm working on as opposed to what I would like to be working on in the future. And by the time I finally release something, I need just a little bit of time to really figure out what appeals to me. Because last, I don't know, April or May, I'm sure I had three or four other ideas which sounded great, but don't necessarily appeal to me right now. And this is what sounds so cheesy, is that often I'll just wait until the idea finds me as opposed to me finding the idea. And once those two things meshed, the idea of a post-apocalyptic Western, and since I'm shooting it in Minnesota, a Midwestern, once those two came together, the idea for the film appeared in my head complete. I mean, there's still details to work out, but I could see that film and I could just feel it. That's what I'm doing next. And that's been the focus ever since. So it's Guns of the Apocalypse. Now, the other thing is I keep calling it a spaghetti Western, and there's a specific reason for that. If you've seen the Guns of the Apocalypse announcement video, which is on YouTube and Facebook, you'll notice that I've incorporated Italian into it. And before you get confused by that, you know, some of the most famous Westerns ever were made by Italians in Europe, starring usually Italian actors and then Clint Eastwood. And they were often shot with actors that maybe didn't even speak English. And so when they brought them to the U.S., they would redub the actors. And so they end up having this strange quality to them where you can totally tell the audio has been replaced and that this is not the voice of that actor. Clint Eastwood, obviously, as an American, was able to do his own voice, but a lot of them were redubbed. Not in like a Godzilla movie way, which is a lot of times when people think of dubbed movies, that's immediately what they go to, of people speaking Japanese, but then they're dubbed over in English, so their mouth doesn't match. The spaghetti Western ones, they mostly match, but they're still not perfect. I've had this idea for a while now, replacing everybody's voice with someone else's, which I find fascinatingly weird, because I always replace the audio of everyone's speaking voice so that I get consistency. I rarely ever record audio live. I mean, I record it, but I don't use it. The last time I did it was with Jim Norgard in Wereskido when he had those big stories as Schramm. And I did that just so that he wouldn't have to memorize it, tell the story, and then recreate the story for me to put in later. I just used live audio, and he was just talking to the camera, so we didn't have to move the microphone around. We didn't need a boom mic. We just literally put a mic over his head and recorded it. But generally, and for like the entirety of Demon with the Atomic Brain, all the audio was replaced after the fact. And several of my movies do that. And in Demon, there are a couple of actors where we switched their voices. We swapped them. And it's a hilarious scene, especially for fans of the films. I want to do that, to create that sort of spaghetti Western feel. So what it's going to be, and it may just be a ridiculous nightmare or the stupidest thing we've ever done, but I think it will add to the ambiance of this particular movie, which is going to be somewhat bleak. I often will pick a word for each movie and just keep saying it over and over again. For Wereskido, it was dark. For Demon with the Atomic Brain, it was fun. This one, it's bleak. It's going to be bleak, but then you're going to have this juxtaposition of actors not having their actual voices. You're going to have some actors who do the actual physical performance, and then you'll have actors who do the voice. I'm going to sync them and match them as much as humanly possible, but I think it's going to be weird and really entertainingly cool. So that's it. Guns of the Apocalypse. That's the next movie. I'm currently scripting it. I'm going to be shooting it early next year with a eye toward a release next October. Just sort of keep this going. The point of the show, obviously, is to talk about the movies and the Mimiverse and all the cool stuff that goes with it, but then also to entice you to perhaps contribute to these films. And you can do that right now by going to gunsoftheapocalypse.com and throwing $25 toward the movie. You get a copy of the movie, you buy tickets to the premiere, you get a cool certificate, you get your name or several in the credits. Do it. So before I wrap this up and send it over to Rich Chamberlain for this month's Kansas City Crypt, I want to let you know about some new, cool, seasonal collectibles that will only be available for a very short period of time, so you need to jump on them. And that is, we now have a Mimiverse 2018 wall calendar. People have been asking me about doing one for years, and I finally did it. They're in my possession. They're ready to go out. If you want to get one, go to SaintEuphoria.com in merchandise under collectibles, the 2018 Mimiverse calendar. Each month is a lobby card image, because we now have lobby cards for every movie, including House of Ghosts and Demon with the Atomic Brain. Those are also available for purchase at SaintEuphoria.com. I took an image from each set of lobby cards and made that the image for each month. And since I now have 12 movies, they go in order of release. So the first month, January, is The Monster of Phantom Lake. February is It Came from Another World. March is Cave Women, etc., etc., etc. Pick one up while they're available, because they will not be for much longer. The other one we have is the second annual Mimiverse Holiday Ornament. And this year, Master Mimiverse Monster Maker Mitch Gonzalez, say that 10 times fast, has created a nice little scale replica of the, well, we call them the Flying Dinner Plates of Death in Demon with the Atomic Brain. And they're awesome. You should pick one up, because they're limited. So you got to jump on it soon, because once we run out, they're gone. And they are individually numbered. The lower the number, the greater the resale value in the future when the Mimiverse does in fact take over the world. All right, so thank you so much for listening to me ramble on for a little while here. Again, check out Demon with the Atomic Brain. Let me know what you think. Maybe if you like it, leave us a review on Amazon. That'd be greatly appreciated. Come down to one of the many events we'll have coming up here, including and especially the Mimiverse Holiday Christmas show at the St. Michael Cinema in St. Michael, Minnesota. We'll have a lot of the stars of Danny Johnson Saves the World there. The robot will be there. Santa and Mrs. Claus, which you can get your kids' picture taken with Santa. I mean, come on. It'll be cool. And it is very much for a good cause. Everybody has been touched by cancer in some way. And so anything we can do to help combat this disease, I'm in. And you should be too. And then go to gunsoftheapocalypse.com and contribute. And let everybody know. Pass around the announcement video, if you would. That would greatly help the Mimiverse to continue. Right now, I'm going to pass it off to Rich Chamberlain for the Kansas City Crypt. And then when we come back, it'll be Chapter 8 of For Your Eyes Only, the novel I'm in the process of writing and releasing to you one chapter at a time about world champion curler and international spy Beef McCormick. And then, of course, we'll have Dr. Bob to close out the show. So for now, take it away, Mr. Chamberlain.
Hello, everyone. This is Richard the Monster Movie Kid, and it's time to open up once again the Kansas City Crypt. This time, I want to talk to you about silent films, or more appropriately, the music that goes with silent films. Now, for those of us who are horror and science fiction fans, admittedly, the silent film era doesn't have a lot to choose from, but the few films that we do have from the silent era, well, most of them are true classics. When you're talking science fiction films, immediately Metropolis comes to mind. This is still considered one of the all-time best science fiction films, and it was one of the first, if not the first, I believe. Now, horror films, of course, we have Phantom of the Opera, Hunchback of Notre Dame, which I always thought was a tenuous horror film at best, but nonetheless, it is a classic because it stars Lon Chaney Sr. Of course, there's other films, The Cat and the Canary, and The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. There's a nice selection of films to choose from. But we always talk about Nosferatu, which is often considered one of the first, if not the true first, horror film. Again, it kind of depends on your perspective. Some people say it's Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. Other films get the credit. I think it's safe to say that Nosferatu was the first vampire film. Now, I'm sure you've heard about the background story of that over the years. The movie essentially is Bram Stoker's Dracula. However, F.W. Murnau never got the permission from the Stoker estate, and so he changed a few things around. Count Dracula becomes Count Orlok. Dracula definitely looks more... he almost looks like a rat in some ways. He's not a very charming vampire. He's rather hideous looking. But aside from the changing of the names of the characters and such, we all know it is the Count Dracula tale. Well, of course, the Stoker estate found out about this and ordered that all copies of the film will cease to exist unless F.W. Murnau was going to pay the licensing fee, of course, which he didn't want to do. And, all film copies were supposed to be destroyed. That, of course, didn't happen. The film had already been distributed. And thankfully, we now have copies of the films still today to enjoy. In fact, in recent years, the film has gone through a wonderful restoration and looks absolutely amazing. I'll say that right up front. If you have only seen public domain copies of Nosferatu, you must absolutely track down one of the restored copies that are out there, because that is really the only true way to watch it. There is so much more to the film, and there's so many of the truncated versions that are out there. Nosferatu barely clocks in at a little over an hour on some of those versions, whereas the restored version with the proper intertitles and the proper film speed clocks in at about, I think, 95 minutes, give or take. That's one of my pet peeves with silent films, is that the film speed has to be correct. And for so many years, we were given films that were sped up, which of course gives us the end result of what appears to be almost comical scenery at times, as characters are moving way too quickly. That's what happened the first time I saw Nosferatu on the big screen. I've had a chance to see it three times now, and every experience was definitely different. The first time was a bit of a disaster. I was still living in Wichita, and the beautiful Orpheum Theater there presents films on a monthly basis. In October, they always go with a Halloween treat. That particular year, they gave us Bela Lugosi's 1931 version of Dracula, followed by Nosferatu. Unfortunately, they didn't have live music accompaniment. They were using, apparently, a very poor DVD version because the music was so horrible. I had to walk out about halfway through. People were laughing at this film because it was turned into a comedy because of the sped-up nature of the film presentation and the horrible music. It was really, really sad. Thankfully, when I saw the film a second time, I was able to see it with the correct speed, the restored version, and in a beautiful setting at the Kauffman Center here in Kansas City with live organ accompaniment from a wonderful organist by the name of Dorothy Papadakos, if I'm saying that correctly. And she wrote her own original score for the film. It was truly a magnificent experience. Well, this past Halloween, I had an opportunity to see it on the big screen again. And while the performer didn't do an original score, it was a very traditional organ score with a bit of percussion thrown in, a few sound effects here and there, which actually didn't deter from the presentation. It was a beautiful restored print. The setting was the Grace Cathedral Church in nearby Topeka, Kansas, which was an absolutely amazing setting for a night of fun, spooky films capped off by Nosferatu. And Marvin Falwell, who is, of course, a local personality, gave an amazing presentation. It was just fantastic. Not quite up to the level that Dorothy and Kauffman Center presentation from a few years ago did, but still, live music is just the absolute way to go. And music is so important when it comes to silent films. As you dive into these silent films, as you begin to explore some of these films like Metropolis or Phantom of the Opera, you're going to have multiple ways to see them. Most are in public domain, but oftentimes the prints aren't going to be the best. Do yourself a favor. Fork out the money for the best version possible, the restored versions. Most of these have been restored in the last 5 to 10 years, and the prints are absolutely amazing. The experience is a vastly improved one, and you owe it to yourself to see the best possible print from these classic silent films. And when you do that, you're getting true music that's supposed to go with it. There's thought that's gone into these official versions so that you're getting the best musical experience possible short of a live music event. It will make all the difference. As so many of these films are available in public domain, you're going to be seeing truncated versions, horrible prints, and horrible music, or in some cases, no music at all, which is, again, not the way to see these wonderful films. If you have an opportunity to see a silent film on the big screen with live music, you must absolutely attend. Whether it's a horror film, a science fiction classic like Metropolis, or if it's a comedy, one of the Buster Keaton, Charlie Chaplin, Harold Lloyd comedies, or maybe something you've never experienced before, do yourself a favor and attend. For several years now, I've been attending the Kansas Silent Film Festival, which is in Topeka, in the last weekend of February. It's been an amazing experience. But nothing quite tops seeing films like Nosferatu and Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Oh, that's another one I forgot to mention. I had a chance to see that a few years ago as well with live music. When you see these films, it's just truly, truly an amazing experience. But again, if you don't, you're not doing yourself a favor, and you're probably going to come out of it less impressed. I've heard people talk about silent films, and they really don't, they say they just don't get it. They said the film is too old, the music is horrible, and I get it. There's nothing worse than hearing watching a silent film where you're hearing the same piano playing the same 10 minutes over and over and over again. I've had that experience too, and you're just better off walking away from the film. That is important. Music, proper projection speed, and I think you'll get to enjoy these classic films. Because these films, these classic silent films, are what inspired the Universal horror films of the 30s and 40s, the Hammer films of the 50s and 60s, well, and quite frankly, the Mimiverse films of today. This is Richard, the Monster Movie Kid, closing the Kansas City Crypt. Take care. Until next time.
Thank you, Mr. Chamberlain. Your contributions are entertaining and much appreciated. And now, it's the time you've all been waiting for. The next chapter in For Your Ice Only, the ongoing serial about championship curler and undercover spy Beef McCormick. Here we go. For Your Ice Only, Chapter 8. Every step Ivan Bentonov took was pure misery. The chemical rush which had engulfed him in his fight for freedom from the police station had worn off, and the snow and cold were no longer doing enough to counteract the myriad of wounds scribbled upon the bottoms of his feet. His full-tilt run had mutated into a sad, limping shuffle, and the cooling sensation provided by his sweat had ganged up with the bitter winter winds to slow him down even further. With so much actively working against him, the periphery of Bentonoff's field of vision had begun to look like the static of an untuned television set. Through it all, however, he remained unwilling to give up. Ivan Bentonoff earnestly believed that dogged determination, intense focus, and an unflappable will to succeed were his greatest attributes, and directly responsible for his ruthlessness on both the curling ice and in the spy game. Now, as he hobbled excruciatingly through an unfamiliar town, he drew heavily upon these facets of his personality to strong-arm his mind to center upon survival. The pain, blood loss, and encroaching hypothermia made his thoughts feel muddled and slow, but he knew he had to push all negativity away and trust his instincts to lead him in the right direction. The Phantom Lake Canoe Corps headquarters from which Bentonoff escaped was located on the outskirts of an unevenly bifurcated small town, half of which was located in one state, Wisconsin, and the other in another, Minnesota. Bentonoff wasn't sure which half was which or within which he was, but as he half stumbled through this foreign burg, he found himself wandering into an alleyway in a small culinary district. Running out of energy and unable to cope with the pain any longer, his knees buckled, sending him crashing into an outcropping of trash cans. The clattering ruckus scattered an army of screeching alley cats and dumped rotten refuse onto the pavement. As he lay in the festering stink of cheap, partially eaten meats and moldy side dishes, he took the opportunity to catch his breath. Unconsciousness sang sweetly in Ivan Bentonoff's ear, but he stubbornly refused to listen. He took in huge lungs full of putrid air, using the cloying stench of decay to force himself to stay awake. He stared up at the sky and, for the first time, noticed big, puffy, light clumps of snow falling all around him. The quiet beauty of it felt out of place compared to the acute pounding ache in his lower extremities. As he silently took in the spectacle, the soft peacefulness of it soothed him, thus allowing him to wrestle his frayed synapses back into submission. With a heavy groaning push, Bentonoff creakily found his way to his knees. He scanned the length of the alley and took note of several back doors, any of which, he surmised, could be unlocked. Grinding his teeth to gird against the coming shock, he gingerly placed his left foot on the ground. Electric waves of hell shot through his ankle and up through his hip, but it was not enough to stop him from continuing. With near superhuman resolve, he worked through the stinging torment and somehow twisted his body into a standing position. Just then, a door further down the alleyway swung open. It smacked hard and loud against the brick exterior, and a husky, sweating mess of a man stepped out into the briskness. The man's head was lacking hair, but, thanks to the undersized, sweat-stained undershirt he wore, Bentonoff could clearly see the rest of him was covered in a downy layer of wiry, salt-and-pepper hair. The soiled apron tied around his waist pegged him as a cook and, based solely on the man's dingy appearance, not one who took much pride in following food safety regulations. The man produced a cigarette from his pocket and pressed it to his lips. With a snap of his wrist, a lighter appeared, its flickering flame bringing momentary relief to the man's decades-long nicotine addiction. As the man repeatedly inhaled tobacco exhaust into his lungs, Bentonoff marveled at how the cold didn't seem to negatively affect this bald walking carpet, a symptom, no doubt, of the man's own natural fur coat. Within minutes, the man finished one cigarette and lit the next with the glowing cadaver of the first. As he flicked the butt into a puddle of slush, he gasped in surprise when he noticed the random, underdressed person standing amidst a jumble of toppled garbage cans further down the alley. "Hey, buddy, you all right?" the man called out. Bentonoff said nothing. "I said, are you all right? It's awful cold to be standing around out here without a coat." Bentonoff remained silent and simply stared off into space. "Hey, buddy, I'm talking to you." Still no response. Confused, the man shrugged his shoulders and turned to re-enter the building. As he sucked down the last hit of his smoke, he hollered a terse adieu. "Suit yourself, pal." Not entirely feigned, Bentonoff's voice came out pathetic and thin. "Please help me." The man slowly spun to face the sound and said, "What's that?" "Help. You lost or something? Please." Bentonoff felt a modest pang of guilt playing on the man's goodwill, but, in a hard lesson learned countless times on the curling sheet, sometimes you just have to adjust to whatever is presented to you, and it's rarely, if ever, pretty. The cook cautiously made his way toward Bentonoff, and, the closer he got, the more pitiful the trash-covered Russian secret agent began to appear. It wasn't until the woolly chef noticed Bentonoff's blood-caked socks that his guard truly came down. "Whoa, buddy, what happened to you? Where are your shoes and coat? What happened to your feet?" It was at this moment a fully formed plan blossomed in Bentonoff's gray matter. Faking drunkenness, Bentonoff slurred. "Wife threw me out. Was down at the bar. They threw me out. Couple of punks pushed me in too." Bentonoff clumsily threw his hands in the air. "Here. Took my coat. Wallet. Took my shoes." Bentonoff figured the extra emphasis on the word shoes would help sell his impression of heartbreaking inebriation. "Now, I'm in the garbage." The man nodded non-judgmentally and remarked, "Yeah, I can see that." The man's genuinely empathetic tone made it easy for Bentonoff to assume the cook's unkempt appearance may have been the result of having once experienced the real-life version of Bentonoff's present fabrication. Bentonoff doubled down on the ruse. "I think I might have stepped on some glass." The man edged to Bentonoff's side and gingerly placed his arm across his shoulder. "Yeah, I think you did, so why don't you just let me help you out? Come on. I ain't gonna carry you, but I ain't gonna let you do all the work, neither." Bentonoff milked the faux intoxication for everything it was worth. "You know what? You..." Bentonoff hard swallowed an imaginary mouthful of vomit, the act of which made the cook gag. "You're a good guy. I can tell. I want to buy you a steak. Doesn't steak sound good right now?" Playing along, the man chuckled. Yeah, thanks. That's real nice of you, but first, we need to get you into the restaurant, get you cleaned up, and maybe get an ambulance down here to look at those feet." "No!" Bentonoff purposely said the word louder than he should have and awkwardly pushed the man away. "Buddy, we've got to take care of them or you could lose them. No ambulance. No cops." Bentonoff angrily shook his head before whispering, "No cops. I don't want to go to jail." No, buddy, you ain't going to jail. You ain't done nothing wrong." "How do you know?" Bentonoff let his fake mood veer into melancholic self-reflection in an attempt to clandestinely evaluate the man's character. "I mean, I didn't mean to hit my wife so hard. She just deserved it." The cook laughed raucously before adding, "They always do. Believe me, I've been there." Since Bentonoff's job operated on an egregiously questionable sliding scale of morality, he reveled in the knowledge that the wanton sincerity in the man's laughter definitively removed the potential for guilt Bentonoff may have encountered as his plan unfolded. Maintaining the tipsy charade, Bentonoff guffawed along and patted the bulky man's moist shoulder. "Oh, yeah?" Bentonoff's question was more accusation than inquiry. "Oh, yes. They always deserve it." Bentonoff found himself inconspicuously disturbed by the legitimate mirth in the man's belly laugh. Bentonoff chuckled along for a few seconds more before turning drunkenly serious. "But no cops. Deal. No cops. And no ambulance. Suit yourself, buddy. Now let's get you out of the cold." The man's assistance made the short walk into his kitchen only slightly less unbearable, but not by much. Once through the door, the rush of warm air made Bentonoff feel like he had walked into the arms of an angel. The man quickly escorted Bentonoff into a small back pantry filled with wooden crates containing various perishables. Bentonoff parked himself on a large wooden carton of onions, and once the cook excused himself, Bentonoff was finally able to remove his socks and get a good look at the damage. Strangely, they didn't look as bad as they felt. In fact, there seemed to be fewer cuts than he thought there'd be. The man returned with a pair of buckets, each filled with warm water, and positioned them in front of Bentonoff. "Since you don't want any professional help for those puppies, this is as good as I can offer. I need to get back to work, but you're welcome to stay here and soak the feet. It'll help clean the cuts and loosen them up to make it easier to get any glass out. As soon as I can, I'll bring you something to eat and some coffee." "What is it with these people and coffee?" Bentonoff wondered, annoyed. "Sounds great," Bentonoff lied. "There's salt in that water, so be prepared." Bentonoff raised an unsteady thumbs up. The sweaty chef smirked and shook his head as he left the room. Bentonoff took a deep breath as he let each foot hover over the buckets. He hesitated just long enough to psych himself up before dropping each into the warm brine. The salty sting was brutal and immediate. His whole body shook in response, but he refused to let the agony overwhelm him. Clenching his teeth, Bentonoff forced himself to focus on the details of the room as a distraction. He read the names of the produce stamped onto the outside of each crate, studying each letter slowly and methodically. He tried to physically remember how each item tasted and felt on his tongue and going down his throat. Finally, after what felt like several lifetimes, the pain began to subside and, eventually, transformed into a manageable sense of mild anguish. Over an hour ticked away before Bentonoff pulled his thoroughly wrinkled right foot from the bucket and dug a handful of glass remnants from his wounds. Once finished, he moved on to the left, which contained twice as much. Finally, the man reappeared carrying a steaming cup of black coffee. He set it on a stack of crates filled with carrots near Bentonoff before picking up the buckets of pink-tinged water and leaving the room. Bentonoff eagerly grabbed the mug and took big gulps of the hot, bitter drink, so thirsty that the foul taste didn't even faze him. As Bentonoff guzzled the last drops, the man re-entered the room with two fresh buckets of salt water. "Just so you know, the restaurant will be closing within the hour. Keep soaking the feet, and as soon as the waitresses leave, I'll bring you some dinner, and then maybe we can talk about what you're going to do next. Deal?" Feigning the approach of sobriety, Bentonoff smiled and blinked slowly. "Deal." Bentonoff relaxed and let the saline solution work its magic, its bite diminishing with every passing minute. He waited patiently, listening to the muted sounds of the restaurant as it shut down for the night. He eavesdropped as the waitstaff clocked out and gossiped about the night's patrons. Shortly thereafter, the cook rematerialized and presented Bentonoff with a plate exquisitely decorated with boiled potatoes, steamed broccoli, and the most beautifully prepared T-bone steak Bentonoff had ever seen. Famished from the day's madness, Bentonoff polished off the meal in a matter of minutes. The cook watched in amused astonishment. "Any good?" the man probed facetiously. Bentonoff put the plate and its accompanying silverware onto the nearby stack of carrot crates. "It was delicious. My compliments to the chef. How are the feet?" "Much better, thank you. Anything else I can get you?" "If it's not too much trouble, I would love another cup of coffee." "Not a problem. I'll be right back." The man exited the pantry and walked into his kitchen. As he searched for a new coffee mug, he thought about how he still needed to finish cleaning and do some light prep for the next day's business. Eventually, he found an acceptably clean cup and emptied the last of the pot into it. Carefully, he returned to the back room and, without warning, felt the ripping shock of a steak knife being plunged into his chest by the person he believed to be a down-on-his-luck, soon-to-be-divorced average Joe. Lying on the floor, the man felt his life slowly leaking away through the jagged hole in his heart. The last thing the furry short-order cook experienced was a sensation of someone removing his shoes. And that's it for Chapter 8 of For Your Ice Only. Join me next month for the next installment, where more exciting stuff will happen. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much for supporting the Mimiverse. And don't forget to go down to gunsoftheapocalypse.com and contribute to this new film. It's going to be awesome. Before Dr. Bob Tesla, the official horror host of the Mimiverse, tells us another one of his world-famous jokes, I have a little advice for you. And it may sound somewhat familiar, and it goes something like this. Be good. But if you can't do that, be good at it. I'll talk to you again soon. Dr. Bob, take it away.
It is I, Dr. Bob Tesla, with your Mimiverse Joke of the Month. Since this will be for November, I figured we should go with a Thanksgiving joke for you all. A woman has gone into a grocery store to get a frozen turkey for Thanksgiving, and she was having a lot of people over for Thanksgiving, and she couldn't find one of the turkeys that was big enough for her family, so she turned to the stock boy, and she goes, "Don't these turkeys get any bigger?" And the stock boy looks and goes, "No, ma'am, they're dead." While we are on hiatus from our monthly live show, make sure you check us out on AltSpace VR as we will be starting a new weekly program. We just had our big three-night event with Christopher R. Mims, the Giant Spider. And then in about a couple of weeks, we will be starting our weekly program off with Slave Girls on the Moon from Joshua Kennedy. Check it out at AltSpace VR. Check out all of our information at www.midnightmonstermovies.com. Like us on Facebook and YouTube so you'll always know what's going on.